Hi, this is Daniel Chalkett.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition. We never make mistakes. Manton, I can't believe it actually happened. I feel like I'm waking up from a dream or something. I actually shipped Marsit at 3.
Congratulations. It's awesome. It's been, what, like 2 years in the making or something?
Technically 2.5 years since 2.0. So I've obviously had some incremental releases since then. But yeah, some of the stuff in this release has been, you know, checked into version control in one form or another for quite a long time. And it's one of those things where, you know, the time passes and for whatever reason, you can't share it now. Like, I did a lot of changes in 3.0 that I then in turn built on to make implementing some of these features easier. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you're familiar with this, but you get to this point where you have a, you know, like something like a relatively simple feature, like I added in 3.0 the ability to edit WordPress pages.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's all well and good, but the way I did it, it wasn't like transplantable back to 2.0. So I couldn't even like take some little stuff out and easily put it into the 2.0. So I'm just stuck with these features that people are begging me for and begging and begging and begging. And I'm saying, you know, it started to get embarrassing. My forums were like, one of the downsides of being responsive is that people start holding you to it. Right. So, some other developers just never address, customers who are requesting things. And so I have these situations where, I'll get a forum message or an email that says, I'm still interested in WordPress pages, and you said it was a high priority, quote, a year and a half ago, you know? It's like, oh, no, it is, it was. I'm just a person, please, you know, don't hate me.
And there's always, like, when I build sort of a major feature, the problem I run into, and I don't know if it's the same thing with the Marsit pages, but you build it and maybe it's like 95% of the way there. But if I don't finish and ship it like right away, then I have to go back later and sort of figure out, was it 95%? Was it done?
Right.
Were there some bugs that I forgot about? And then it takes longer to catch up. And I'm a little bit in that position now with the major new version of Clipstart that I put on hold. And I know when I go back and finish it, it's going to take an extra week or two to like remember where I was in the project and what pieces were actually done and not.
Right. I definitely had that happen here in 3.0 as well. I went back and I had mentally signed off on some of the features being done because I had done most of the hard work, but then there was like little fine tuning edges on some of it that I was like, oh, I have to do that. You know, I have to go back and fix that. And, that's always sort of a bummer because if you've mentally signed off on something being done, then you sort of get to the end of the project and you're like, oh, I still have another week of dumb work, you know? And it's like, as anybody in our audience knows who is a developer, probably a lot of other creative fields as well, it's unfortunately always possible to come up with another week of work, you know? Like,
yeah, it's true.
And that's why the discipline really is to finally be able to call something done for the moment. And for everybody out there who's like waiting, especially you folks just getting started on either the Mac or iPhone, iPad, and you've got like your Linux version scheme 0.9.537, got to get to 1.0. I mean, it just changes everything. And I'm always reminded of this when I'm working on a big release and when I finally release it. It's like I was saying, you can always come up with another week's worth of work. At some point, you're not going to get real feedback about your app unless it's 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, whatever. There's at some point, you know, even if you've got a lot of beta testers, you're not going to have a real sense of what needs to be done. And one of the ways I comfort myself and think, okay, it's okay that I'm shipping with all these little issues that I know about, because I'm in exchange for that sort of risk and exposure and the fear of failing and being embarrassed by what you've done, you get in return actual real feedback, you know, and it's like suddenly your life transforms from fixing, you know, as many of the bajillions of little things you can find to fixing the five things that everybody has found, you know? And it's like,
yeah,
obviously a better payoff. The feedback loop is healthier. You get to, you know, actually fix things that people are, you know, struggling with, as opposed to, you know, if you just put me in a room with Mars Edit and the next 10 years, in 10 years, I'd still be saying there's a couple more things to fix.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, all the customers are really being cheated because they don't get to use the new features. So I would just like to encourage everybody out there, for your own well-being and for the satisfaction of your customers, get to the next version. You know, you got to get there and then refine. You're never going to refine it all the way. I think actually Guy Kawasaki, who is coincidentally a big Mars Edit fan, I think he has a phrase or sort of a mantra, something like ship bad software or something, you know, it's like something ironic, but it's like, he understands that you got to ship stuff or it doesn't count, you know?
That's particularly good advice for me right now, actually, because I'm with this iPad distraction I'm in. This project has turned into, you know, just every feature that could possibly be added is being, you know, pulled onto this release instead of just getting the 1.0 out there. And there's a few things that are affecting that. And part of it is just the iPhone ecosystem and how nervous I am of actually shipping a product in the App Store with a price that's not 99 cents. And so I'm sort of making sure that every possible complaint, you know, is addressed before I ship, which is a big problem. I should have shipped it a week ago. I should have just focused on what I was actually trying to build instead of adding additional features. But yeah, there you go.
It's a balance. Obviously, you want your product to be as good as possible when it goes public. But there's this kind of funny situation. Maybe I don't know how to quite assess what you would call this technically. But there's this phenomenon that's sort of unfortunate for customers, but it's worth knowing about, which is that the fixes you make after something is public and after people are complaining about it, there's a huge payback in like goodwill in the way customers perceive you and the way they appreciate what you've done that you don't actually get if you just anticipated what was wrong and fixed it ahead of time. And I'm not saying that you should go out of your way to like cause problems so that you can fix them later. but it's kind of a comfort to remind yourself that if there are problems in what you ship, you're going to get satisfaction from users who see you respond to that seriously and fix the problems, you know? And it's kind of an interesting, thing to observe that for better or for worse, you don't get any of that. You know, you get it on a much more abstract level, like somebody who downloads your app and uses it and sort of has like an aha moment when they say, you know what, this app has never crashed.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know what, I've never thrown up my arms in disgust at this app. But that doesn't happen as often because people are tuned in to what's bothering them, not tuned in to sort of the absence of problems.
Yeah.
Like you're walking down the sidewalk in Austin and you're not saying to yourself, my, oh my, the city works department sure has kept this road pothole free. You know,
it's only
when you step in a hole that you go, damn that city works department. And then I'll tell you what, you call them up and they come out, if they came out the same day and fixed it, you'd think I have the best city works department in the world.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the city who's like prevented any pothole from ever happening is, you know, they're okay.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes a problem will draw attention to the fact that another application or another sidewalk is completely smooth.
You're right. You're right.
So, I mean, you could be using one app for years and you just take for granted the fact that it's stable and doesn't crash, and then use a competitor and it crashes immediately, like right out of the gate, then you it sort of
you're right.
refreshes in your mind. Well, wait a minute. You know, this other app is actually pretty good.
You're right. Somebody else's faults can draw attention to your perfections. That's an interesting angle too. So, but you know, I really think, especially with the iPhone and with the iPad, you should double down on your sort of ambition to ship early and to keep things simple for your 1.0.
Yeah.
And you know what? I totally hear you about this, like trying to justify a higher price. Maybe part of your process just has to be having a 1.0 that is sort of overpriced for its feature set. And maybe
that's an ambition of mine, is to ship overpriced iPhone software. I think I'd be cool with that.
and you know what? It's in a way you're going to capture your purest sort of target market that way, because you'll be saying, this is what I think is the absolute necessities for a 1.0 of this product. And if you are in the same like mind, sharing the same like mindset as me, you will see this as something obviously worth $999, let's say. And if you're not, then maybe you'll come back and check it out later when it's sort of more of a full featured thing that attracts you.
Yep.
But I'm definitely thinking about this a lot too, because now that Mars Edit 3 is out, it's like one of the big payoffs for me is it really allows me to finally free up my thinking a little bit and think about the iPad. And I'm going to be trying to follow the same mantra going forward for 1.0. It's just, you know, get something out there, because nobody, you know, Manton, you know this as well as I do. It's so much better to get complaints about shipping software than to get complaints about non-shipping software, especially if it's a product that you haven't even brought into existence yet.
Oh, there's nothing like getting complaints from real customers who just gave you $30 or whatever.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, that's totally good, because you have the right cycle of, you know, the feedback loop happening where, you know, people are buying your software, they're telling you what needs to be improved, you improve it, money goes in your bank account. I mean, it's a good position to be in.
That's right. You run away to the Bahamas, you never answer your support email again. You know, so, well, unfortunately, that does happen.
Well, let's talk about that. You shipped Mars Edit, I guess, about a week ago. Actually, a week ago today.
That's right.
Is that right?
Recording on Tuesday.
Did a Tuesday release. I mean, my whole, you know, list of Twitter people was just lit up with people relinking and retweeting the Mars Edit release. So, I mean, you seem happy with the release, got a bunch of upgrades.
Are you asking I'm rich?
How does it feel? Hey, are you recording from the Bahamas right now?
It feels...
You're breaking up a little bit. I hear the beach.
Here's what happens, people. When you're a one-person operation, even relatively successful as I am, you suffer... especially at a certain level of the company's development, the ups and downs of sales are kind of huge, and they can toy with your emotions. And so there's the regular sort of day-to-day spikiness of sales, which you just sort of get used to. You sort of say, okay, you know what? I'm going to have some inexplicably huge days. I'm going to have some inexplicably like zero days. That's what it's like when you are, you know, starting out, even the first few years, even when you're making sort of enough money to get by on. But then there's the sort of longer scale, you know, the phenomenon of you have a big release, you sell a lot, and then sales sort of slowly decline, hopefully slowly, over a long period of time. And for me, that scale has taken place on a 2.5 year basis. So since Mars Edit 2 launched, sales have gradually declined. And, you know, for a long time, that doesn't feel too bad, but you give it 2.5 years and gradual decline has plenty of time to wear you down, you know,
to
the point where, you know, you can start second guessing yourself. You can start asking yourself questions like, is this really a market that's, you know, sustainable? And so what I was looking for from the 3.0 launch and what I got was validation that there are tons of customers out there who want product like this.
Awesome.
So that's really the biggest payoff I can sort of recount from this is, oh yeah, they care. And you saw, like you said, you saw Twitter go nuts on it. You saw a bunch of the, you know, the Mac press was kind enough to write up stories about it. And I think I'm going to see this momentum going forward now for at least, you know, a few months as people continue to share and spread the word. And that was my big concern was, is this, you know, especially when you spent 2.5 years on something that's just, it's anxiety inducing to allow your imagination to go to like the oh, what if I release it and like there's just the sound of crickets, you know? You're like, mm-hmm. Well, what if I spent 2.5 years on something that, you know, this is another argument for releasing often. You want to spend maybe a year on something and find out that it was a bad idea. You don't want to spend 2.5 years on something and then find out you should have been working on a Twitter client.
Right.
So anyway, that's my, my assessment is it was definitely a great launch. Exceeded my expectations. I said on Twitter it was the best, quote unquote, best sales day ever for Red Sweater, which if you can get one of those, set one of those records every couple of years, then I think you're doing okay. And you can, you know, keep cranking away at it. And, you know, you can set that record with a $50 sales day if you're just starting out. And I remember that. And even that felt great, you know. But just to occasionally have your records broken is a great feeling. And that I think inspires me to keep going.
Awesome. Well, congrats again.
Thanks.
So the 2 years or 2.5 years, it reminded me as I was looking up the episode for the show, we have almost been recording the show for 2 years. We recorded the first episode May of 2008, right before WWDC. And here we are again, 2 years, and WWDC is right around the corner. Since we last recorded, tickets went on sale. They sold out. People complained. People are still complaining, but you're going to be there. I'm going to be there, right?
I am, yeah. And I sort of had like a manic day that morning that they announced it. I was like, ah, damn you, Apple. Yeah. I'm never going. I mean, I am going. I mean, oh, I bought my ticket. And
you went through all the...
Somebody said that, yeah.
All the different levels. You know, it's like you were upset. You didn't want to go. Then you said, maybe I'll go. And he said, I have to be there. It's the price to pay.
Denial.
And I think everyone went through. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And everyone went through that. Unfortunately, some people went through that and could not actually go anyway. I mean, I feel really sorry for international developers who it's just really difficult and extremely expensive to, at the last minute, you know, book an international flight and hotel and, you know, take care of all that stuff. So it'll be interesting. It'll be a weird mix of people this year, I think. And by weird, I mean all iPhone developers and a lot of people that we know not there.
I think you're right, but I've been sort of surprised talking with my friends, the number of people who are going, the number of Mac developers. I mean, I think it's funny because I'll talk to my Mac developer friends and they'll be like, oh yeah, I'm going, you know, I don't know why, it's going to be all iPad. And I sort of can relate to that, but I have to kind of like respond to them like, I think you're right, but in my case, I'm kind of entering a phase right now where I think I'm going to be pretty iPad focused for a little while. So it's pretty good timing for me.
I'm the same thing with me. I'm doing almost all iPhone and iPad right now. So it's actually good timing.
And I think people mistakenly assume that I'm not on board for the iPad and the iPhone. Partly that's because I've been critical of some of the, you know, Apple processes and such. But, the other thing is, this is it, people. Why haven't I done an iPhone app? Why haven't I done an iPad app? Mars Edit 3, take a look at it. That's where my life has gone for the past couple years. And it's like really hard to have the discipline to stay focused on that. But I had to make myself a rule, which was basically I can't do anything else until I get this done. Because, you know, you take a 2.5 year sort of process and you try to sneak in stuff like an iPad app and an iPhone app and who knows what else, having a life, having friends, you know, things like that. They just take away from your ability to ship. So you take a 2.5 year process. And if I would have done iPad apps and iPhone apps and all this stuff, I think it would have been a 5 year process. So at some point you have to like hunker down and just focus on getting one thing done. And now that that's done, I think I'm going to be pretty excited to start digging into the newer stuff. And I felt literally like restricted from being able to work on that. And I was like, you know, we've chatted about this off of the air, and it's like, I really want to go work on that iPad app now, but I can't.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah. It feels kind of good that way too, that I'm freed up a little bit to, you know, as an independent developer, you have the luxury of working on whatever the hell you want to. And, unfortunately that means having to give yourself some strict rules sometimes.
Well, should be good. We'll see there. Any listeners who are at WWDC, please, find us and say hi. So we wanted to quickly correct something in the last episode. We've never made a correction. We're always right, I think. At least we're always right, or listeners don't have heart to tell us how wrong we really are. But last time we were talking about iPad and iPhone universal apps, and this is a case of where both of us are just kind of starting to play with the iPad and iPhone, and it's my fault, really. I think I threw out Fat Binary. Technically, universal apps are Fat Binary, but so are iPhone apps, are ARM 6 and 7. But that has nothing to do with the fact that the iPhone and iPad version, actually, if it's a universal app, the checks are at runtime for different changes. It's not two separate binaries if you're shipping universal apps. So okay. Hunter on the comments on the website pointed that out and said we were a little bit off base there. So
for the record, if you ship an app that's intended to run on iPhone and iPad with the same binary, it is a single entry point binary that contains code to run in an optimized mode for either the iPhone or the iPad, and it contains the app bundle contains nibs for either case. Does that sound right?
Right. And you can do with nibs, you can have different nibs, or you can have single nibs or no nibs at all, and just kind of switch things out. I've gone back and forth about whether to use nibs or not. I know a lot of even experienced iPhone and Mac people have been sort of going away from nibs on the phone a little bit. And I can't make up my mind. I have one project which has no nibs, and all the views in the iPhone app are done in code, which actually does make a universal app a little bit easier in some ways, because you don't have the duplicate nibs where things are almost the same, but there's a popover in this one or whatever. And then I have another app, which is all nibs, but it's an iPad only app. And so there's none of this universal issue.
I think it's the same challenge on the desktop as well. It's like you get some benefits from using nibs and you pay some prices.
Yeah, definitely.
I think I was on Twitter. I think Buzz and Buzz Anderson and somebody else. They were talking about the shortcomings of nibs, and it's like I think Buzz said something like you get to a point where your nib file is just this like shell for all the custom tweaks you're doing in code anyway. And I've experienced this as well. It's like my nibs in Mars Edit, let's say, are just kind of like the merest skeleton of what you're actually going to end up seeing in the app, and you start to wonder like, what am I really getting from this? Maybe it should just be all in code. But then the flip side of that, at least on the Mac, is some of those things that you instantiate in Interface Builder, like buttons and pop-ups, etc. If you ever try to configure a pop-up or a button to behave the same way in code, you can be incredibly perplexing. You're like,
yeah,
what is this flag I need to set? What magic did Interface Builder do for me?
Right.
Or what special customized cell did it embed into the control?
Yeah, completely. And just the size of buttons, like you know, the layout versus the sort of what you actually see. Luckily, those issues, I think, are gone on the phone to some extent. But no, Buzz was who I was thinking of, actually, when I said, you know, some experienced Mac people have sort of gone away from them, away from nibs. But, and IB is a lot better, but especially in previous versions, any sort of complex view hierarchies in IB were a complete, you know, disaster to manage. But it's improved. iPad actually seems fine because, like, in my iPad app, I have a bunch of nibs and they're all very focused. Like, they have like one view in them, you know, and there's a view controller associated with them. And so it's actually, I find that works pretty well.
I think the view controller emphasis starting in, you know, starting with the iPhone really, but it, you know, it sort of is inspiring a lot of people, myself included, to start using more view controllers on the desktop as well.
Yeah.
And view controllers as a sort of, you know, as a sort of way of structuring your UI, I think does lead to better nibs. You know, I have like, you take like something that used to be all in a window and extract it out into separate view controllers and separate nibs for each of, like, say, the separate sections of a window. And not only does that leave you with sort of a leaner set of nibs, but, you know, I've really benefited from this in the sense that I can now easily, you know, move things around if necessary. So I have some UI that's in a main window, let's say, and then you can easily have that same UI in a separate window, whereas before you would have been dealing with, if you were using more monolithic nibs, you'd be dealing with, like, redundant UI, you know, you might have the same UI copy and pasted between two nibs. It's really the same idea as anything in programming where you want to have smaller, more interchangeable pieces. And I think I've been enjoying how using more view controllers has made that, you know, more possible with nibs as well.
Cool. Well, that was notice how we issued a correction that immediately changed the subject to nibs to distract from the But thanks again to Hunter for pointing that out. And you can go to corrent.org/28 for the last episode if you want to see his comment.
I think we could call those, it's incorrect to call them fat binaries because they are, you know, there's a very technical term for fat binaries on the Mac, meaning having separate like forks of the executable. But I think we could call them bloated binaries.
Okay. Well, that's the problem, right, is that Apple has used this universal term for like two or three different things now.
It's true.
All right. So we have a question from Nathaniel Palmer. Short and sweet. What is your system for handling support? And great question. I'm always fascinated with how different developers and small businesses approach this because everyone has a different system, and especially what works for one person may not work for like a 3 or 4 or 5 person company. Right now, mine is, I'm really bare bones. I use email exclusively and I don't have a system for really tracking things. I just make sure I flag and, you know, make a note of things that need attention or customers that need a response. And I always try to respond within a day so that nothing gets, you know, so far off my to-do list that I've forgotten to address it. And then I also recently introduced forums on the website, which I have mixed feelings about, but some people just don't like to send email. And so for them, the forums are available. And sometimes I'll post betas or notes there too that are sort of interesting and useful for people who really care enough to look, but not so important that I'd put it like directly on the website front page. So I don't know. That's me. What do you use Fogbugs now for all your support email or?
Yeah, I do. I use Fogbugs, which has been great. If only for the, it's email plus accountability, you know?
Right.
And it's just, I found when I was doing email, even if I had a dedicated account, even if I used IMAP folders, let's say, to prioritize and organize different issues, there's just something about the formalization of something like Fogbugs, putting a ticket number on an email and tracking it. It'll do things automatically, like if you can set the amount of time in which you should probably have responded, and it will send you a notice if you have like overdue tickets. I use it in conjunction with RSS to actually subscribe to a feed of the tickets that I need to give attention to. So as I'm going down in NetNewsWire, I have a special group in NetNewsWire for all my work stuff. And as I'm going through that, if something has come up that I've overlooked in my Fogbugs inbox, it'll actually ping me right there. And I'll, oh, I was supposed to respond to that guy. So specifically for email support, I do use Fogbugs and I enjoy it. But on a more sort of general level, I really took to heart something that Brent Simmons said. I don't know if he said it publicly or if it was in a panel or online or what. I can't remember, but I remember him talking about how when it comes to support, he believes that you should support customers in the format that they want to be supported.
Right.
Which was basically his rationale for having support through email and through forums. Mm-hmm.
Now Twitter.
Obviously there's a limit there, and I think actually he made that statement before Twitter was huge.
Right.
Because I would like to point out that Twitter support is a real problem. Like, it does not work to get support through Twitter. What does work, I say this having been guilty of it myself, I've occasionally, dropped a quick note to somebody, FYI, this is broken on such and such version. It's still not ideal because it's not trackable. What you're doing is you're pushing onto the developer the responsibility of formally filing that issue. And that's fine, but users should know that they can't have the same expectation of accountability if they're just dropping a comment on Twitter. Sure. I don't know if that's a cop out on my part, but the tools are not good for managing support on Twitter, and 140 characters is not enough. I get these support messages. I always, for the record, I always respond politely, but sometimes I do nudge people to email me. It'll be like, support. I'm having trouble connecting to my blog. Any ideas?
Yeah, it crashes. Why?
It's like I have a lot of ideas, but I can't extrapolate in 140. So I'll say, I'll say something like, we're really good at tracking down these issues. Email us support@redsweater.com.
Yep.
So on a larger scale, like, I think I agree with what Brent said about supporting people where they want to be supported. But for me, the way I've sort of formalized that is email is the canonical support system. That means to me that if you want to be officially supported, like fulfilling the implicit contract of your relationship with Red Sweater, if you want to be tended to in the way that you are entitled as my customer, then you have to email me. That said, I respond to every forum post that is left with an open question. And I try to respond to every Twitter that is in the form of a question. But as I said, sometimes that's just directing people to the more appropriate support venue.
Yeah, I think that's completely reasonable. I do the same thing. I don't get a lot via Twitter, but if I get something, if I can answer it, even if I can answer it in 5 words, I'll still say, it's probably this, but please email and we'll go into more detail. There are some services now, like, built on top of Twitter for doing things like that. Like, CoTweet is one of them I've noticed for, like, businesses to manage, Twitter accounts and replying to people and stuff. But that just seems overkill to me. And I have a real hard time getting past, I never want to have a discussion on Twitter with someone that goes past like 2 or 3 tweets at the most. Even friends, if the conversation is going past a couple tweets, I'd prefer to take that to direct message.
Yeah, it's just not just the right. It'll just clutter not the right up medium. The
timeline.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Another thing I'll just mention is one of the sort of like, I don't know if it's like one of the superstitions of my building Red Sweater has been to be like absurdly attentive to support and to customer issues. So, on top of like Twitter, forums, and email, I'd like to put out there that one useful form of support is to do proactive support, which means you're monitoring like blog search engines and, you know, mentions on Twitter that are not directed to you, but which obviously express some kind of dissatisfaction or a question, even if it's not directed to you. So I'll find like blog posts where people are like, you know, wondering openly whether MarsEdit supports something, or tweets between people saying, I don't think MarsEdit lets you do that. And I can kind of just chime in. It's a fine line whether you're interrupting, barging in, or whether you're, you know, being welcome, welcomed to kind of solve the problem. But I take the initiative there and go in and say, hi, this is Red Sweater, and the answer is blah. And that's just to include that in the sort of whole roundup of what how support is handled. I think that's an incredibly powerful tactic to use if you're out there and you're starting your business and you want to start like building some real passion among your users. People flip out when you blog, when you go to their blog and you comment on it. And I think we've talked about this on the podcast before.
Yeah, we have.
But it's like, I didn't know you read my blog. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, well, you sort of say like, well, I don't really, but I still care. I still care about what you're saying here, you know? So anyway, that probably rounds it up.
Yeah, I think that's a wrap.
All right.
And I like what you said about Brent's comment about reaching out to users and the support that they, avenue they like. So I'll be phoning in to the Red Sweater support after the
show. That's right. Good. Send me a fax.
Questions.
Send me a fax.
Right.
Oh, I do support by IM. I do SMS support.
Right.
No, I don't.
I'll flood your SMS account with overcharges.